great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. And you know what? It's time to talk about your income taxes. Mary Mellum, our guest of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. She and her husband, David, have been in the tax business for more than 30 years. They serve individuals. They consult other tax professionals. And they teach tax seminars around the country. And Mary's been with us many times and does a wonderful job. What questions do you have for her about filing your taxes? Maybe you changed jobs this year. Maybe you sold your house, wondering what you need to do. Join the conversation. Give a call. The number 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. Mary Mellum, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning. Good to be here in a nice, warm setting.
I tell you what, people smarter than I am can file their taxes beginning January 26th. I am nowhere near ready for that. But I'm wondering, when is that 2025 tax return due? Is it the normal April 15th?
It is the normal April 15th. I believe April 15th is even on a weekday, so we don't have any extension for the Saturday, Sunday, or holiday part either.
Okay, and what happens if you miss?
If you are not able to file your return by April 15th, and you know this ahead of time, filing an extension will give you up to 6 months to do it. It is not an extension to pay your tax, but it is an extension to avoid failure to file penalties, which are a half percent per month.
Which can be quite a chunk of money.
It's 5% per month. Half percent is failure to pay, but it's 5% up to 25% max that if you miss it, if you don't pay your tax on time, you're looking at a substantial penalty and interest on top of that. So you want to file it as expeditiously and correctly as possible.
There's a new Schedule 1A form people should know about. Is that right?
Yes. This has been a busy year, and my kudos to IRS for being as prepared after the signing of One Big Beautiful Bill that IRS has done a good job of getting forms out and getting a lot of information out. There are still questions, and there will still continue to be some confusion and questions, but this form Schedule 1A is in the collection of schedules that have been produced over the years for the tax, and it contains four of some of the popular changes that I call it OB3 has brought to us. It includes the deduction for tips, for overtime, for car loan interest, and the senior citizens deduction. So all four of those are calculated on the form Schedule 1A, and then the result of that form is taken to the tax return itself.
So let's take that no tax on tips bill. Who, I assume, if you're a wait staff person?
Well, the IRS... First, the Secretary of Treasury and then the IRS came out with a list of most common or commonly tipped employees and or commonly tipped people, because employees is not exactly correct. And so in order to qualify for this deduction, you have to be on that list of commonly tipped employees. And it's a pretty broad list. We think about the common things like you mentioned, the bar and restaurant, the transportation tips, the beauty shop tips, things people who provide services to you. And that's kind of the place for it to be. But in light of that, as we look at that, you have to be on that list, first of all.
So if you're in a business and they say you're going to get a bonus at the end of the year for work that you've done, that would not qualify as a tip?
Correct.
That would not qualify.
You're correct. These have to be qualified tips, and the definitions and the practical side of this is what's going to be confusing for this year. They have to be qualified tips, so qualified tips have to be voluntary tips. If you go to a restaurant and it's a large group of people, 6, 8 or more, sometimes you'll see on the bottom of your bill that it says the gratuity is automatically added on. That's not a voluntary tip, and that tip does not qualify to have to be deducted. There's some of the problem gets in with this is that what's qualified and what's not qualified and who has these numbers. And the answer to that is the employer. But keep in mind that this bill did not pass until halfway through the year, and therefore there's still confusion. So IRS, in its infinite wisdom, has said that the employer should calculate and give the employee the number. But if you don't have that number, there is box 7 on the W-2s, which says tip income, and it's subject to Social Security. So that number for 2025, you're able to use to calculate your tip deduction. Next year, the employer will have to do the calculations separating out what's qualified and what's non-qualified. And there'll be new reporting requirements on the W-2 that don't exist because of the timing of this year.
Be interesting. You know, the coffee shop I stop at is on campus. And what the owner of the coffee shop did was raise the price of everything. I don't know the percentage. Was it 15 or 20%? Because students typically don't tip, and then gives the tips out to, you know, that part of the income is, or the money taken in is, goes to the workers as tips.
Well, that's wonderful, except those aren't qualified tips.
Okay.
Unless a person has the option to decline that tip or change that tip, it's not a voluntary tip. So, again, for this year, box 7 of the W-2 is what we're going to be using. But next year, the employer is going to have to come up with that. And when the employer tells you how much, or when the business owner tells you, the client, how much you have to pay in a tip, that takes it away from being voluntary. So there's lots of discussion that we could have with the tips. It's not an easy issue, and there will be more coming out for clarification than is out now. But for this year, it's made simple.
Got it.
Get your W-2, look at box 7. If your employer didn't tell you anything different, you can use box 7. The tip income is also available for self-employed people, but tip income has to be in, tips have to be included in income to be deductible, and they have to be separately identifiable. For the self-employed person for 2026 or 2025, it's going to be next to impossible for the self-employed person to get that because we don't have that identification ability.
Yeah, that makes, I understand that makes some sense. I was going to ask you about filing, and Sandra in Madison has a question relating right to that. So let's go to Sandra. Sandra, hi, what's on your mind?
Hi. Well, I understand there's no more free filing. So if I have a little time to run around, do the paper forms, am I better off saving a little money by sending in a paper form?
Okay. That's a wonderful question, Sandra. The free the direct file is gone. That was the program created by the IRS, which cost us as taxpayers a horrible more than $30 million for them to create that program. But that program is gone. But the free file program that has been around for many years still exists. You can go to irs.gov, type in free file, and there are eight, they call it trusted partners, that you can see the provisions listed at the website of which one of those providers you might fit into and might use. So it's pretty much, except for the one year and the pilot year that we had the direct file, the free file that's been in existence for a long time still exists.
So, and you need to have, there's an income maximum, I think, isn't there, for a free federal?
If I look at the free file program, the highest number of any of these providers would be 89,000. Now, again, when you go to the IRS website and look at that, each program has their specifics regarding it that you can look at and decide, do I fit into this? And also keep in mind, for senior citizens, ARP in ARP programs and other programs through maybe through your municipality offer filing help for people. So if you feel that your tax return is one that you just need a little help with or something, try those means. Sandra did mention mailing in your return. My last source would be to mail in a tax return. It takes so much longer to get that tax return processed by mailing it in. We still have a few forms that we cannot electronically file for one reason or another. But for the most part, electronic filing is the way to go.
Sandra, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. While we're at it, let's take a call from Larry in Rice Lake. Hi, Larry.
Good morning. My question is regarding HSA funding. Each year, my wife and I donate the maximum to our HSA account because we have a high deductible insurance plan. We both do. 2026, I will turn age 65 and convert to Medicare in October. My wife will remain on the marketplace plan throughout the year. So I'm wondering, since we typically donate the max to our HSA account, is there like a prorated amount we'll be able to donate for 2026 because I turn 65 and we'll fall off the
government
plan?
I don't know. When your wife, I don't know who has the insurance in their name. If you have a joint policy, then you're doing it based on joint income. And then when it's no longer, when you go to Medicare, it probably flips to a single policy in your wife's name. So you could do the joint, if you have a joint, you could do the joint for the first 9 months, your prorated portion of that, and then she could do the other 3 months as the proportion of the single person. But it's wonderful to put as much away in the HSA as you can. It's a good thing.
It is indeed. Larry, thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too, with your tax questions. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at your taxes today with our guest, Mary Mellum, tax professional from Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals of Green Bay. Great to have her with us at 12:30. Today, Dr. Joseph Zenga will be talking about immunotherapy treatments for head and neck cancer. Some promising work there. So looking forward to talking with him. But right now, it's your taxes. Thomas emailed to ask how he might take advantage of the tax provision relating to auto finance interest. Is this available only if you itemize, or can it be used by all filers with a U.S.-built vehicle?
That's a great question, Larry. And the answer is you do not have to itemize in order to take advantage of that. This is one of the provisions that's included on the Schedule 1A that we've been talking about with the tips. There is a catch to it in the sense that you must have purchased the vehicle in 2025 or later. You have to have the VIN number for the vehicle. The vehicle has to have been final assembly in the United States. When you look at the form, it will have a VIN number needed on that form. And generally, the VIN number has to reflect where it was final assembly. And pretty much it is VIN numbers that start with 1, 4, 5, and I believe that there are some in the 7 area that reflect cars, vehicles that have been, a final assembly has been in the United States. You can deduct up to $10,000 of interest. There is a phase out range. So for single people, it's $100,000 of modified adjusted gross income. Or for married joint people, it is $200,000 of modified adjusted gross. If your income is higher than that, there is no there is a phase out of the deduction. Again, the form takes care of all of that. But it is a new vehicle that you have purchased and you have a loan on it. You have to be able to find the amount of interest. This year, we don't have a form that specifically tells you that, but you can go down back to the bank, you can go back to your finance company and get the information from them for this year. Next year, there will be a new form that comes out have that information on. And one thing that I want to mention about the Schedule 1A and the tips over time, car loan interest and the senior deduction, they are a 4-year term. In other words, there's an expiration date on them. These provisions, however nice they are, in the bill, they exist for 4 years starting in 2025. So at the end, 28, after 28, they're set to expire. And with things like that, we'll have to wait and see as we get closer what will really happen to them.
Yeah. And the state, Wisconsin State Assembly passed a no tax on tips bill mirroring the federal bill, but I don't think the Senate has passed that yet.
I haven't seen that it's passed. This morning I did go out to the website and took a look at the fact that there is legislation out there to address the tips, and I believe the overtime as well, that Wisconsin, the way the form works, these deductions for federal are what we call below-the-line deduction. The line we're talking about is AGI. And so for federal purposes, if you qualify, they will affect your bottom-line taxable income. But since Wisconsin starts with federal adjusted gross income, none of these provisions affect our Wisconsin return. And Wisconsin would have to do something on its own, like this proposed legislation, or we would continue the Wisconsin return the same way we always have.
Yeah. Christina in Glenwood, we'll go to you now. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. Mary mentioned on Schedule A senior deduction. What is that all about?
It is on Schedule 1A, and the senior deduction is, it's an answer, and this is my opinion, it's the answer to no tax on Social Security. If you think back to the elections, and it's hard to think back to the ads that we heard and didn't want to hear all the kinds of ads. But one of the proposals was that no tax on Social Security. That did not happen. And the offset to it is that instead of having no tax on Social Security, there was a deduction for senior citizens. Now, the deduction for senior citizens is eligible to anyone who meets the conditions that is over the age of 65 at the end of the year. It doesn't have anything to do with Social Security itself. So if I'm over 65 but have chosen not to collect Social Security yet, I still have the opportunity for this deduction. It is a $6,000 deduction, and it has income limitations. Your income, and this new form starts out with the calculation of the income that you're using. It's called modified adjusted gross income. For most of us, it's adjusted gross income. But if that number is more than $75,000 and you are single, then you may get some of the $6,000 deduction because it phases out. If your income as a married couple is under $150,000 and you're both over 65 at the end of the year, the deduction is $6,000 plus $6,000. And again, the phase-out range applies. It isn't a situation where if I have $75,000, $1, I get the deduction.
You get
so
no.
It's phase out.
It's phase out. So you even at $78,000,
will still get it. Its phase out is a 6% phase out. So you aren't losing it totally, or even a little bit over is not going to affect it a great deal.
Yeah, Christina, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Mark, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mary.
In light of, since you brought up Wisconsin before with the tips and the overtime, Wisconsin has a complimentary deduction for it. It's also a senior citizen deduction for anyone that is age 67 or older. But be careful with Wisconsin, because in order to get the Wisconsin deduction, and I believe the deduction is $24,000 for a single and $48,000 for a married couple, if both are over 65, over 67. But in Wisconsin, if you take that deduction, you are giving up the opportunity to take any of the credits, like the property tax credit or the married couple credit or other credits on the Wisconsin returns. Mm. So do that cautiously.
Okay. And again, Christina, thank you very much for your question. Mark, near Shawano, we go to you. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Larry. Well, she answered the question I was going to, excuse me, ask about. That was I already got it now.
Oh, okay. So if you're on, Mary, basically, if you have no other income but Social Security income, you're probably not going to be in a tax situation, or is that the case?
You're right. If your only source of income is Social Security, you're not even going to have to file a tax return because it's not going to be taxable. So these deductions mean nothing to you.
Got it.
You have Social Security and you have some other types of income as well, and your income is below the 75 or 150, they're certainly going to be a help in reducing your taxes.
Let's turn to Robert in Amherst Junction next. Hi, Robert.
Hi. My question about the senior deduction is that I need to take money out of a state retirement fund. And, you know, the state of Wisconsin, they won't let you take a little bit. You got to take the whole thing. And so then I'm anticipating that some of that money I'll have to put back into another IRA. But with the senior deduction, I'm wondering if that money that I take out of a retirement account applies to the adjustable to the gross income or used for that.
If you're taking money out of the state retirement because you're over the age of 73, where you're required to take that money out, the money is totally, you know, it's totally taxable to you. If you are taking it out because you're closing out the state retirement and you're rolling it over into an IRA and you don't keep the money, then that money doesn't go into your taxable income calculations. So where you said rolling over some of it, that would mean that it's not taxable if you're eligible to roll it over. But anything you keep will be part of your taxable income that will go towards the $75,000 or $150,000 limitation.
Robert, does that help?
Another quick follow-up, please. If my Social Security and plus the amount of money that out of the retirement is less than 75, then I won't have to worry about paying taxes on it. Is that right?
No, you'll get the, if what you're describing, your Social Security plus your retirement is under $75,000 and you're single, then you're going to be able to take advantage of the $6,000 deduction. How much over it is, you know, will determine what your taxable income is. So without knowing all of those numbers, I couldn't tell you exactly where you're, you know, where it's going to be.
Yeah.
You're certainly over the filing requirement. And depending on how much retirement you take out will determine whether your Social Security is taxable or not. And then all of that will go together to determine your taxable income. But you would be eligible for the $6,000 deduction.
All right. Robert, thank you very much for calling. We'll turn to Rich in Appleton next. Hi, Rich.
Hi, good morning. I had a question about a home improvement loan that I got through the state of Wisconsin. It is a no-interest loan, and I got all new windows and an air conditioner, and I was curious about any tax deductions or any rebates that I could apply for.
Well, the energy credit did terminate with OB3 this year, and so if you bought qualified windows, doors, furnace, air conditioner, and they were installed by the end of 2025, there is potentially an energy credit that would still exist for that year, for federal purposes. You need to check with the person that you bought those products from to make sure that they're qualified. They have to meet certain energy specifications to qualify for it. But this would be your last opportunity for the energy credit that we know now.
Rich, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Lyria emailed us to say her husband passed away this summer. He did their taxes for 36 years, filing jointly always. Lyria says he was very detailed-oriented and actually enjoyed sitting down and filling out all the forms. She has no interest in doing this now. Do you have recommendations on how to find a qualified tax preparer?
I certainly. You can go out to the IRS website and Google tax preparers. I believe they have a list of enrolled agents on their website, or qualified annual filing season people. If you're around here, there is an organization called NATP, National Association of Tax Professionals. They have a website that you can search there also for professionals. What I recommend, just because I'm biased in this way, but look for someone that has credentials. An enrolled agent is a tax specialist. An annual filing season record of completion person, it's AFS, I believe is the acronym that is used, indicates that those people have kept up to date and have taken classes to qualify for those designations. So I think that that's an important thing to do.
Yeah, I do as well. There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Fred in Eagle, Wisconsin. Hi, Fred.
Hey, Mary. Hey, Larry. Thank you very much for having us. This is always a great time of year when you have Mary on. So I have a question about how we have to estimate our annual income for the healthcare marketplace. Let's say you establish your expected income for the year 2025, but you exceed it by maybe $1,000 or $2,000. Mary, is there anything that a filer can do to reduce that previous year's income so it's, you know, at or below the estimated annual income that you established your healthcare marketplace income at?
Okay. In the end, the premium tax credit is what you're talking about. And if you go to the marketplace and tell them your income is going to be a certain amount, they set your premium and the subsidy that you qualify for based on what you've told them. If your income turns out to be higher than that, then some of the subsidy you pay back in the form of additional tax. If your income comes lower than what you tell them, you may get a premium assistance credit, the difference between the subsidy you got and the subsidy you really qualified for. It's determined at the end of the tax year. So if you had insurance for 2025, you paid based on the amount of income that you had, and it turns out to be higher. The normal tax saving technique to get your income down would be something that you try. If you happen to be working, putting into an IRA is something that might help you do that. If you did it before the end of the year, you might have been able to sell some stocks, you know, to offset your capital gain. Those are kind of the things that you're going to look at. The marketplace is based on total household income. So being able to reduce your total household income would be the only way, you know, that you'd be able to do that. I guess IRAs are the biggest thing at this point that I can think of that would be a place to do that.
Hmm. Fred, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Peggy emailed to say she forgot to withdraw the required minimum from her IRA. And so she took it in the first week of January for last year. What should she do?
There is a form 5329 that is a penalty. Technically, because you didn't take it out on time, there is a penalty, and it's a 25% penalty of what you should have taken out. It used to be 50. They reduced it to 25, but they have some other specifications. So it's a form 5329. I recommend that you fill it out and you claim the idea that I've corrected it, and take a look at the instructions. It's page 2 of the 5329. There is an ability to avoid the 25% penalty, but walk through the instructions for it. And it was her best move to take it out as quickly as she remembered, and to remember to take out the distribution she needs for 2026.
Yeah, for sure. Bob in Janesville, we'll go to you next. Bob, hello.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My daughter had a problem with credit, and she wanted to buy a house. We found one. I put the house in my name, and we executed a land contract with matching terms. So technically, it's a wash for me from my point of view. Do I need to do anything on my taxes special to acknowledge that?
Okay. Who's paying? I assume it was a mortgage that you were able to get.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Okay, so the mortgage is in your name, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and does she pay the mortgage or do you pay it?
I pay it directly, and then she pays me, just okay. So I have control.
Okay, and the idea, it's what we call a wraparound mortgage. It's technically her mortgage, and so you would be picking up income, the interest that she's paying you, and she would be able to deduct the interest that she is paying you, and you would take a deduction under investment interest expense. And technically, you should be charging her a little bit more than you're paying to make it qualify as investment interest. But it's the idea of a wraparound mortgage. She's technically the one that is buying the house. It's not your money that's buying the house because she's paying it off. But you have to report the income that she pays you, the interest income, and you would be deducting the interest expense through itemized deductions that would allow you to offset that interest income that she's paying you. And that way she gets to have the deduction on her tax return.
Got it. Bob, I hope that helps. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Willem and Colfax, on to you now. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I was wondering, is there some time or age limit when you, like, I'm going to be 75 and I'm self-employed? Do I still have to file a Schedule C? Or is it dependent on my Social Security income? And I guess that's the question I have. Do I still have to pay self-employment tax on?
And the answer is you can be self-employed to 105, and you will still pay based on your self-employment income. So there is no limitation to how long you pay into the Social Security system if you have earned income.
So you got 30 more years, Willem. You'll be 105 and you can...
All right. I'll keep going then.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too. We've got open lines. Get you on pretty quickly with your tax question. The number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email. We've had some good emails as well. The email address, talk@WPR.org. Hope you join in. I'm Larry Mueller with Mary Mellum for WPR News. Another mention about the Garden and Green Living Expo. I will be broadcasting from the Garden and Green Living Expo on February 13th, so Friday the 13th. And you can join in, get free tickets. Go to WPR.org/events, and you need a ticket to get in. You'll find out how to get one right there. We are talking taxes with Mary Mellum from Green Bay, from Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. And if you have a question, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. We had a question about estimated taxes and self-employment. What's estimated tax and who has to pay it?
Estimated taxes are for people who have income that is not subject to withholding and or who choose not to withhold out of their income. They owe tax. The government expects us to pay ahead for our taxes to avoid penalties. And so estimated tax payments are quarterly payments that are determined to cover your tax bill and sent into the government on a quarterly basis. They're due April 15th, June 15th, September 15th, and January 15th.
So it's a good thing if you are not you don't want to avoid that.
To avoid underpayment penalty, you have to pay, when you file, 90% of the taxes that you owe, or 100% of last year's tax. So when you set up estimates, the easiest way is to go based on the prior year's tax, unless there's a difference in, you know, income that's either up or down from that. But if you cover last year's taxes, you know, dividing it by four and sending that to the government, that will help you pay and avoid a penalty. That's the whole point of estimated tax payments, because if you owe the government money at the end of the year, they have the opportunity to collect interest on that money and underpayment penalty. And if you don't pay by April 15th, there's also failure to pay penalties. So all of those penalties can be avoided by paying as you go, if you want to say it that way.
Kay in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Kay.
Hi. Good morning, and thanks for taking my call. I have a very deep-in-the-weeds of tax laws question. I am soon to become a self-published author, and I have this vague recollection that if you're a self-published author, it comes under the designation of that it's a piece of art and has some kind of special tax category or something like that.
I guess I'm not sure what you mean by being art. But if you're a self-published author, your royalties that you get for selling your books or the sales of your book is taxable income. You're able to deduct the cost of putting the book together. As you sell each book, there's a cost that went into that book, like publishing the book, and there's a cost per book that you have that offsets that. I'm not sure where the art fits in, but that's how an author reports their income.
Okay. There you go, Kay. Thank you very much for calling. John in Mount Horeb, your turn. Hi, John.
Yes, thank you. I have a question about financial gifts to children and their spouses. My wife and I are considering making a financial gift to our son and his wife, and we'd like to understand the limits on those gifts before they become taxable either for us as the giver or for them as the receiver. If you could clarify that, that would be appreciated.
Sure. First of all, let's talk about the income tax side of it. There is no income tax on gifts. The only time a gift is subject to tax, it is an estate gift tax, and it's on it's a valuation tax, not an income tax. And under the Big Beautiful Bill, the amount of estate/gift tax that can be given over your lifetime before any tax applies is $15 million. So most people do not have gift taxes that they have to pay. Now, if you die and your estate for a single person exceeds $15 million, and your gifts that you've made in a lifetime, if they were what we call taxable gifts, go into that $15 million. If that computation is over $15 million, then the excess is subject to a 40% tax rate. So that being said, most of us do not have to worry about gift and estate taxes. However, there is a filing of a gift tax return, and that's where the amount of the gift that you give may cause you to file this gift tax return. It's a Form 709, and it's filed to keep track of those taxable gifts that might go into that $15 million calculation. So here's what the gist of it is. If you are giving a gift to someone that they can use immediately, and I mean that as opposed to a gift that they can't touch until maybe they turn 21 or 32 or something like that, that gift is called a gift of a present interest. They can use it right now. That gift says you don't have to file the 709 form until the gift exceeds $19,000 to one person. If both you and your wife give a gift to your son together, that would be $38,000. And you can make it larger that if you include your son's wife in it, it could be $38,000 times two between you and your spouse, before you would have to file a gift tax return.
Hmm.
Now, I just want to say the other type of a gift, if you set up a trust and put money in a trust for your children, your grandchildren, that's not a gift of a present interest. That's a gift of a future interest. And if you give a gift of a future interest, that gets you file that on a gift tax return, even if it's only a dollar.
Oh, John, does that help?
Yes, that's very helpful. I appreciate your thorough understanding. We certainly don't have to worry about the $15 million, but the $19,000 number is kind of what I was looking for. So we could give, both my wife and I could give $19,000, if we wanted to, up to $19,000 to our son, and separately $19,000 to his wife.
Correct. Without needing to file any gift tax returns.
Yep. There you go, John. Thank you so much. Gary and Ripon, quick comment?
Yes, after the big, beautiful bill passed, the only reports I saw just simply said no tax on tips, no tax on Social Security. They did not list any of the qualifications that your guest has mentioned, which I'm sure are true. But I think this is going to make life more difficult for her this year.
Okay.
I agree with you, Gary, that the advertising campaigns don't always tell everything you need to know. And this year is going to be an interesting, confusing year. First of all, because the IRS doesn't have everything out there to help. And they've done a good job with the tips and overtime of trying to simplify it. But there's more to come.
Gary, thank you. And Rita in Madison wondering, she heard you say there's a special tax deduction for folks 65 and older. She's wondering if there's a particular form. What's the form?
The senior citizen deduction on the federal, age 65 or older, is contained on the Schedule 1A.
Schedule 1A. Rita, there you go. Get yourself a look at Schedule 1A. Well, our guest today, Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon and Tax Professionals. And Mary's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today to answer your questions, and certainly hope you join in. We are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News, and then we'll be back with Mary Mellum. I'm Larry Mueller. Talking taxes on the show today. Larry Mueller here. Our guest, Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals, back with us once again. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon tax professionals. They serve individuals, they consult other tax professionals, and they teach tax seminars around the country. So, questions for them, I hope you'll join in. You could email us to talk@WPR.org, or if you'd like, you could call us, the number 800-642-1234. Give a call. And let's take a call from Amadeo in Madison. Amadeo, thank you for calling.
Hey there. Thanks, Larry and Mary. Good morning to you all. I had a question about education expenses paid and if there is a tax credit. I'm used to previously, I'm going back to school, and last time I went to school, I did pull out loans. I do know there's a tax credit for interest paid, but I was wondering if it's any different because I'm very fortunate. My employer is giving me tuition reimbursement, and if there is a tax credit, does that kind of change whether or not I could claim that credit?
That's a great question. If your employer, your tuition reimbursement is not money you paid, so you are able to take a tuition credit. Do you have a degree currently?
And this, I do, yes, definitely.
Okay. And so you probably or someone took the American Opportunity Credit when you were initially going for your undergraduate degree. If you use that credit four times, that credit is not available, but the Lifetime Learning Credit, which is a 20% credit based on your tuition. If your employer doesn't pay all of your tuition, you could get that credit, the 20%, based on whatever part that you had to pay yourself. Again, there are phase-out ranges, so depending on what your overall income is, may determine whether you qualify for the credit, but the credit does exist. And Wisconsin also has a tuition deduction that is eligible for tuition paid, and again, it has an income limitation.
Hmm. There you go, Amadeo. Thank you very much for calling. Carol in Wanakee, it's your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hi. My husband and I have money in the EdBest 529 accounts to pay half of the tuition for our grandchildren. In 2024, my husband, our last grandchild is enrolled in college right now, and my husband forgot to ask for reimbursement from the plan. He didn't realize that it had to be requested within the same calendar year, and so we decided to go ahead. Our options were to leave it in then for the to convert to a Roth IRA, and we have some money left over. We still have to figure out what to do with the kids who've already graduated, but it was quite a bit of money. It was $26,000, so we requested the money then in 2025, and if I understand correctly, that it's a non-qualifying event, but I think we only will have to pay penalty on whatever growth that money incurred from when we should have taken it out in 2024 until we did in 2025. I think there'll be a penalty and then some taxes, and we are going to have our accountant deal with this. I just wanted your guest thoughts.
If you are taking money out that is not used for qualifying expenses, then you're exactly correct. It is the interest that money has earned that is subject to tax.
Okay.
So you're exactly correct with that. You mentioned Roth IRAs also. I believe last year was the first year for it. If the money has been in for 15 years and you get to the point where that the account person is not going to use it, and there's no one else to roll it to that's qualified. If that money came out for a Roth IRA, that money would only be eligible for a Roth for the person that is the beneficiary of that account. So if you thought about rolling it into your Roth, that wouldn't be an eligible rollover. It would be like taking the money out and paying the penalty and or paying the tax and using that money for a Roth contribution, not a rollover. And then that would mean that you have to have earned income and things like that. So before you use the Roth, make sure you understand who qualifies, whose Roth it would go into.
Yeah, and with the daughter, let's say it's going to go to the daughter, to turn that to a Roth, there's some limits of the amount, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, I believe it's $35,000 total that could be rolled into a Roth for the beneficiary of the account. But you're right, there is a maximum limitation. And there's also the account had to be open more than 15 years, and you can't roll over anything that was contributed in the last 5 years. So there is a little, there is more to it than just a rollover.
Yeah. Carol, there you go. Thank you for calling. Let's turn to Mike and Marinette. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry and Mary. Thank you for the call. The question on RMD, I wrote my company out in out east in December requesting the RMD for the accounts, and I have not heard back from them or received any RMD payout. What's my options?
Ouch. I assume you're over 73 by the end of the year of 2025.
I'm 82 going on 3.
Okay. Have you worked with this company before?
No. My original financial advisor changed companies that they dealt with.
Okay.
So I had to go direct to that company.
Unfortunately, if they didn't cut the check by 12/31, it doesn't count as a rollover as an RMD for that year. I would contact the company and say what's going on, and if they were cutting it and didn't cut the check till 2026, your 1099-R would come in the 2026 return. But I would take a look at the 5329. You certainly have a reasonable cause basis for avoiding the penalty as long as you get it out as soon as possible and take the distribution that you should have for 2026. I guess I would talk to your current financial planner and see if they couldn't help you contact the company and find out what's going on.
Yeah.
It just seems like it got lost and that shouldn't happen. Worst case scenario, if you can't work with that company, you might think about rolling your funds from that company to somewhere else.
Yeah, for sure. I have a friend who does the RMDs, and he takes his whole RMD at the first part of the year just to get it over with.
And safe measure.
Yeah, it's one of those. He apparently donates all of it to a nonprofit, so he just does the whole thing at the beginning of the year, and then he doesn't have to worry about it.
And what you're talking about is a concept that is called QCD, Qualified Charitable Distribution. And that certainly is a way to avoid paying taxes on the money by sending it directly to the charitable organization.
Yeah. Jerry in Kokana, we'll go to you now. Hi, Jerry.
Yes. I understand there's limits on how much you can put into a 401k. Your own if you're self-employed. And for last year, I believe it was $23,500, but if you're over 50, there's a catch-up provision. Now, if you only made $23,500 and you're over 50, you can't put it in any more. Am I correct on that thinking?
Correct. You're limited to the amount of income that you earn, certainly.
There you go, Jerry. Thank you. Bob in Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'm a retired federal employee, and one of the benefits of having a supplemental insurance is they advertise, and in my experience it happens that if you bundle A and B on Medicare, if you have Medicare A and B, you can get a rebate of X amount of dollars, and it happens. $900, I get a rebate every year. So when I itemize, I don't usually use that full premium of my of the supplemental insurance. I just subtract the $900 that I get, just because it seems sleazy, actually, that the way they've got it set up.
You do exactly, that is exactly correct, that you can't claim a deduction for more than you paid your, that came out of your pocket, if you will. So you're doing that exactly correct. It's the net amount that you base the deduction or Wisconsin deduction on as well.
Yeah, so you're doing it right, Bob. Thank you very much for calling. Jay in Washburn, your turn. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. My question is regarding taxes on Social Security for my minor dependents. So I'm recently retired, planning to take Social Security, and I have two kids still in school under age 18. And my understanding is that we can claim a certain proportion of Social Security for those dependents, but I'm curious how that will all be taxed.
If a dependent is receiving Social Security, and I'm not sure of your circumstances, I'm familiar with it when a parent dies and the children get Social Security. But at any rate, if the Social Security is paid to the child, it will be taxable to the child just as if the child were an adult. If the child has no other income, none of the Social Security is taxable. If the child has a summer job and makes a lot of money or has a trust account or something like that, it may be taxable. But the child at the end of the year would get the same type of Social Security statement that an adult would. And it would say child's name, or it might say your name, guardian or custodian for the child. The important part is to look at the Social Security number that that document comes in, and it should be in the child's name. Most times, children receiving Social Security benefits do not have tax consequences.
Mm.
Not that they couldn't, but most times it doesn't happen.
Jay, there you go, and thank you for calling. Jeff emailed to ask, if you live in one state for most of the year but then move to another state before the end of the year, where do you file your tax, your state income tax return? And in each state, based only on the income you've earned during that time you reside in that state?
That's a great question. If you move physically to another state and take up residency in the other state, you will be filing two state income tax returns, one for the state you moved from and one for the new state that you are a resident of. Wisconsin's form is a one NPR, and you would be filing that form whether you moved out of the state of Wisconsin or if you're someone that moved to Wisconsin. You would file that form for the part of the year that you were in Wisconsin. You would file whatever the other state's equivalent of that form is for that state. And if you actually took up residency in Wisconsin or in another state compared to the other, you include the income that you earned in each state on each state's return. And I say that with a little caution, because Wisconsin, I think, is very territorial. Wisconsin has a form, a residency questionnaire that you fill out, and they ask all kinds of questions like, did you maintain a home in the other state? Or Did you maintain some kind of, if you moved out of Wisconsin, did you maintain a home in Wisconsin? Do you come back to Wisconsin? They're making sure that you really changed your residency. Otherwise, Wisconsin's going to want income tax on the whole amount. So depending on what you did, if you have questions, take a look at the residency questionnaire that is a part of the Wisconsin tax program, and you'll find the questions interesting. But each state wants their share of their income.
Okay. Thomas, there you go. Thank you for calling. Lynn in Pewaukee emailed to say they received that the senior deduction is available for those who are 67, not 65, and wondering what's the proper age.
Okay. The federal government's age is 65. The state of Wisconsin's age is 67. So, great point. There are two different things. And again, the federal is, I would say, black and white. You do not, in neither case, do you have to have Social Security to qualify for these deductions. For federal purposes, you qualify for the deduction. The only catch, and we haven't said this before, that you cannot file married separate to get the deduction for federal purposes. I don't think that's a condition with Wisconsin, but I wouldn't swear to it. I haven't looked at it. But the age is clearly different. Just be careful on Wisconsin, because if you take that deduction, and 24 is certainly higher than 6, but if you take that deduction on Wisconsin, you give up any credits that are associated on the Wisconsin return. I watched slides that Wisconsin had, and they say all credits, and they list Wisconsin Code 71 such, but as you look at that, you're talking about homestead, you're talking about the veterans credit, you're talking about property tax credit, the married couple credit, itemized deduction credit. Your benefit by taking that deduction has to outweigh the benefit that you would have using those deductions. So be very careful of that.
Jane is wondering, what should people be careful about if you're using an online service like TurboTax, for example?
Well, if you're using a reputable service, the safety and security of those services should not be a question. If you're using some unknown service, that's a whole different story. But what I find with people who do their own taxes through those services, they never bother to keep a copy. That if they go somewhere else the next year and someone asks them for a copy of their tax return, or you fill out financial aid papers, or you need a copy of the tax return for some purpose, many times people who use online services do not keep a copy, whether it's an electronic copy or a paper printed copy. So that's one thing. If you're going to do that way, be sure you read questions carefully and know what you're doing, because you can do a lot of things and they may not be right. But be sure you preserve a copy so that you know what you have sent to the government.
That's pretty good advice. And just to go along with that, let's say you make a mistake on your tax return and you believe the IRS maybe sends you an incorrect refund amount or deposits their refund incorrectly, what do you do?
If you discovered that there was something wrong on the tax return that you filed, the only way to correct it is by filing an amended tax return. I don't know how the online softwares handle amended tax returns because I don't use those. I don't know if they have the capability or if you would have to do it by paper. But you know to know where you started with, and if you don't have that copy, you could be in trouble.
Yeah. And Thomas in Oshkosh actually has a question. I think that may relate to that. Thomas?
Hi. Yeah, my question is, what should you do? What are the steps? What's the process to take if there is a problem, that is, your W-2 is wrong in terms of the amount that was earned last year? My wife's W-2 is off by a considerable amount, almost half.
Okay.
And well, wanted to know what we need to do.
The first thing that I would do is go back to the employer and point out the problem. The employer should amend the W-2s and send corrected copies to the government. If you can't get that done, and you're saying that they didn't report as much as she should be paying taxes on?
Yeah, and we get automatic deposits, so we have all the deposits that we got from them, so we know how much she made.
I would definitely go back to the employer. There is a form 4137 when you don't get a W-2 that would tell the government, I'm reporting this extra money. First of all, it's all whatever is wages that is qualified wages is taxable, even if the W-2 is wrong. But I would start with the employer and find out why they didn't do it right, or is there another W-2 that you should be expecting? Like, you know, there was a company that merged, and one company did its own, and one company did its own, and that's why the total that you got is not there. So go back to the employer first.
Thomas, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And boy, we've covered a lot here today, Mary. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. We covered a lot. I guess probably didn't get to every possible thing, but maybe next time. I hope you can do this again with us.
I will be happy to.
All right. Thank you so much. Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay. She and her husband David operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. And they've been in the tax business for more than 30 years, and you should be able to tell that just by listening to her very good answers to your questions. Coming up, we're going to talk with surgical oncologist Dr. Joseph Zenga about immunotherapy treatment for head and neck cancer. That next. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for staying with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention to immunotherapy. It's already an alternative treatment for some advanced cancers that are difficult to treat otherwise. But immunotherapy may have greater potential for killing cancerous tumors in the head and neck. And we'll be talking about that. Somebody's been working on this, Dr. Joseph Zenga, Chief of the Division of Head and Neck Surgical Oncology and Reconstruction at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's an associate professor. And a new study by Dr. Zenga and his colleagues suggests immunotherapy has a greater role to play in the fight against certain cancers of the head and neck. Have you or a loved one received immunotherapy as a treatment for cancer? Do you want to know about side effects compared to that of surgery or radiation? I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Joseph Zenga, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks so much. Really happy to be here.
You're a surgeon specializing in the head and neck. And how much of your practice is treating people for cancer in the head and neck?
All of my practice. So I spend about 50% of my time doing still surgery and clinical medicine. And then the other 50%, I run an NIH-funded research laboratory here. And for me, those go hand in hand. I can't do one without the other. But there's more cancers of the head and neck out there than you realize. Most of what I take care of are cancers of the aerodigestive tract, so mouth, throat, voice box, but also skin of the head and neck region.
Oh boy. Surgery and radiation, probably the traditional options for treating head and neck cancers, but there are downsides for patients undergoing these treatments, I'm guessing.
Yeah, unfortunately, immense downsides. When cancers are small, surgery works great. It's highly curative. People do really well. The body heals amazingly. But when cancers get to be larger size, you get really profound effects. That's effects on speech and swallow, as you can imagine, really long recovery periods, and cosmetic things, right, that are really a big deal for people. And so personally, I want to live in a world where, my kids can grow up and you don't have to radically alter a life to save it. And so that's really what motivates our push towards immunotherapy.
Yeah, I'm thinking about this. It's not only the physical, but the mental aspects of this have got to be great for many patients.
Yeah, it completely changes your life. I mean, big picture, how this works is you might have a 6 week, an 8 hour surgery, a 6 week recovery after that 8 hour surgery. Some people need a feeding tube while they're healing up. Some people need a tracheostomy to protect the airway while they're healing up and the swelling's going down. Radiation itself lasts about 6 weeks. So now that's 3 months of just treatment. And then you need months of recovery to get back to a new normal. And that new normal is different, right? You have lasting side effects. So although that is the best way to currently save lives, we need to be doing something better.
Yeah. So immunotherapy, first maybe basically explain what it is for those who may not be familiar with it in any form.
Yeah, absolutely. So it turns out that in all cancers, there are actually immune cells. There's lots of immune cells in every cancer. The problem is most of those immune cells either cannot recognize the cancer as a foreign entity. They don't have the right stuff on them. They don't have the right receptors to actually recognize cancer as foreign. Or they're blocked by something, right? So cancers hold up, let's say, molecular stop signals. They hold up these stop signals, and it doesn't allow the immune cells to kill them. And so current immunotherapies, like the ones that are FDA approved and you can currently get treated with, Keytruda or Opdivo, These are actually really simple in how they act. They are antibodies, which are basically little molecules that will go into the tumor and they'll hide the stop signals, right? Those cancers hold up those molecular stop signals. The drugs will just hide the stop signals, which allows the immune cells that are already there to start killing cancer, but only if they can recognize cancer as foreign. And so that's what my work focuses a lot on, is actually figuring out which immune cells have the capability of recognizing cancer as a foreign entity and killing it.
Yeah, and so immunotherapy is now available, as you're suggesting, for some types of cancer.
Yes, but they're, like I said, they're relatively straightforward. I think we're still in the early stages of what immunotherapy can do, because if you don't have the immune cells already in your cancer that are capable of recognizing it as a foreign entity and killing it, assuming you alleviate those stop signals. If you don't have enough of those, the current immunotherapies, they're not going to help because you need enough of those immune cells already present for the immunotherapies to take effect.
You've done some research and published a study. You and your colleagues identified particular proteins in cancerous head and neck tumors.
That's right. So it turns out that one of the reasons why cancer is so challenging is that it's like 99.99% normal. There's actually very few targets. If you think about it, You know, why is this different than infection? You know, your body clears most infections on its own. And that's largely because things like bacteria and viruses, they're all foreign. There's just tons of targets for immune cells to recognize. But in cancers, there's very few targets. And so what our big search for us is identifying targets in cancers that that can identify it as foreign, that are not expressed in other areas of the body, so that if we give immune therapies to go target those proteins, we're not going to hurt the patient. And what we found is that there are a selection of proteins that are expressed by some cancers that really aren't expressed in the rest of your body. And we're trying to take advantage of that and develop therapies that can recognize when cells contain those proteins and kill them, which would selectively kill the cancer without hurting the patient.
How do you go about this research? What's the it's interesting to me just what the process is that you go through.
Yeah, so this all rests on patients being willing to participate in the process. And I got to tell you, my patients have been remarkably generous with their time and energy and sacrifice, because we need tissues. We need biopsies. It's the only way to really understand this. You know, you can do studies in mice and other things, and those can be useful. But if you really want to know what is driving human cancers, we've got to look at them. And so, you know, my patients have been extremely generous in consenting, you know, with sort of institutional approved methods, consenting to allow us to take samples from their tumors. And we're able to do actually amazing things these days. You know, technology's advanced to the point where, you know, if you asked me 10 years ago if cancer was curable, all cancer curable, I would have said no. But ask me today and you'll get a different answer. And a lot of it is the speed and accessibility of technology. So I can take a biopsy from the operating room and take it back to my lab. And in 10 minutes, we can break it up into all the individual cells within that biopsy. And then I can run it through a sequencer where I can sequence every individual cell of that that mix, that single cell mix. And then I can analyze that data actually myself now, because it's, you know, all this stuff is so accessible, and tell you what every single cell in that cancer biopsy was doing at the time that we took it out. And that is not just the cancer cells, but also the immune cells in there. So we can look at the cancer cells and say, what are they expressing? And we can look at the immune cells and say, how are you acting in this cancer at this moment?
That's amazing. Absolutely amazing. And so there's something within our own immune systems. So you're taking something from a person's individual immune system. You're finding the proper cells that will attack cancer, that could attack cancer. And then you're, what, putting a load of those into the back into the person?
Yeah, so that would be the idea. So what we do is... we try to do it in a highly targeted way. And so if you can do this, where you sequence each individual immune cell, what we can do is actually get the gene sequence for the receptor that those immune cells use to recognize cancer as a foreign entity. And so that's how this works, is the immune cells inside of cancers, you know, they recognize cancer as foreign based on what's called a receptor. It's basically a molecule that sits on the surface of that cell and can say yes or no, you're a foreign entity or not. And if we can get just the right one, the current technologies allow us to get the gene sequence for that receptor. And with that in hand, I could take, for example, a blood sample from a patient and take out all the immune cells that are nonspecific. They're not helping, you mm-hmm. know, kill cancer. They're nonspecific. And we can use gene editing. And we can switch out the receptors from the nonspecific ones to the ones that, you know, we think are killing cancer. And then we can give that back as a product. So that would be the dream. That's what I spend night and day working towards. And I think that we'll get there. It's just a matter of time.
So are you able to actually work on people and you know, try these things out as you go along?
I wish that we could do that. There's a lot of regulations, and rightly so. But we're working basically to develop these products in the lab. We then test them in model systems, And when we get enough data to satisfy the FDA that this is a reasonable and safe thing to do, then we have to round up the funding for the trial, and then we can do a formal clinical trial. So the reality is these things are decades in the making, but they're coming. We're on the way.
Talking today with Dr. Joseph Zenga, Chief of the Division of Head and Neck Surgical Oncology and Reconstruction at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's also an associate professor. Great to talk with him about his research on immunotherapy as it relates to head and neck cancers. Could probably expand that out a bit and talk about the same process with other cancers as well. But he's got some really interesting research here. And if you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. We're taking a look at immunotherapy as it relates to cancers. We've zeroed in on the work of Dr. Joseph Zenga, Chief of the Division of Head and Neck Surgical Oncology and Reconstruction at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Great to have him along today. A quick mention, tomorrow on the show, we'll talk to a couple of conservationists about a possible sandhill crane hunting season in the state, and then we'll talk to Stan Cox about his new book. It's titled Anthropause. That's tomorrow on the show. So more needs to be done from the sound of it. What are the next stages of your work here, of your research?
Well, I can tell you it's a lot of grant writing. So, this is the life of a surgeon scientist is all these things, they need resources. And so I spend time taking care of patients and I spend time in a lab. I spend a lot of time writing. And so really the next steps are getting the NIH back online and hopefully getting, additional funding in the door to continue these studies. But in terms of the next practical steps, we need to get more data to validate that these things work, in a petri dish, and then we can, go to the FDA and ask for what's called an IND, which allows you to run a clinical trial.
So so the timing out of that is probably a bit of time yet before that all comes to fruition.
Yeah, it takes like 5 to 10 years, to get from an idea to a clinical trial. It just does take that long. And science is slow, right? Because you have to do it rigorously. It takes a while to plan and do these experiments. And science is hard, right? Like many times science fails and you have to just be persistent and perseverant to work through what fails to find what actually works.
Yeah, that's for sure. But I'm guessing that you're going to find willing participants. I've had a friend, more than one, who's gone through various cancers and were invited to try various trials, and there's discussions about the trials. But in all cases that I'm aware of, in terms of my own friends, they were more than happy to go through those trials.
I agree. My experience is that, again, patients are extraordinarily generous and interested in moving things forward. I can't tell you how many patients have said, for like a biopsy or something else, I get that it won't help me, but if it helps someone else, that's enough. Of course, interventional trials where it might help you too, right? So I think there is a lot of interest and we're excited to move things forward.
Diana in Portage, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I have a question for the doctor. He mentioned that he's going to be running
writing NIH grants. What's happening with NIH these days, and how much faith do you have in grant writing success?
It's becoming harder. They're slowing things down and slashing budgets, and that is hard. We don't have full clarity on what 26 is going to look like. I can tell you I have firm, unshakable faith in the scientific process. I don't think the NIH is going anywhere. It's going through a little bit of a rough time, but I am highly confident it will come back strong, and America will remain a leader in scientific progress.
Joe was wondering, how do you know if a cancer patient is a good candidate for immunotherapy, or would any individual be a candidate?
That's a great question. So, and unfortunately, we don't have fantastic answers to that as a specialty. This is another area of active investigation. There are these molecular stop signals, as I mentioned, in tumors. And if your tumor expresses a lot of it, if it has lots of molecular stop signals, we have found that tends to mean they're a reasonably good candidate for immunotherapy, but it is by far not a perfect measure. Like, a lot of work needs to be done to make sure this is better. For example, in head and neck cancers, the actual drug that we use is Keytruda. And patients, you know, if you give them this drug, only about 10% of patients have really a truly major response to this drug, like the cancer melts away, which means 90% of patients don't. And so if we need to do a better job at picking out that 10%.
Yeah, I'm wondering about its benefit. Even if it doesn't kill it all, it still might make it easier for the other treatments?
It might. And so we're actually opening up a clinical trial here that will be open this summer where we're going to give immunotherapy and then to shrink the cancers basically as much as possible. And then we're going to give radiation afterwards. And then when the radiation has taken effect and shrunk the cancers, you know, as much as possible, we'll do a more limited surgery to remove whatever residual disease is that has not responded to those treatments. We're hoping that boosts not only cure rates, but ideally functional outcomes, right? I'm a surgeon, but I want to do as little surgery as possible. I mean, realistically, right? Like, I want people to be happy and whole and function well. And if surgery is beneficial for that, I can do it. But if surgery is, you know, is hurting patients, I don't want to do that.
Yeah. So the treatment itself, if you injected, or I'm not sure how something like this would be done, would it be an injection for head and neck cancer, or would it be a pill, or what?
Yeah, so the current immunotherapies that you can give are IV injections, and the drugs are antibodies, which last a really long time. They last for weeks in your body. And so you only have to get one injection every about 3 weeks. It just depends on which drug it is and stuff. Sometimes it's 2 weeks, sometimes it's 4 weeks, but it's only a single injection every few weeks. Now, the risk of the current immunotherapies are there are some side effects, and it's because the current versions of immunotherapies, again, these antibodies that cover up the stop signals, they go everywhere, and they're not just specific to the tumor. So if you have inflammation sort of other areas in your body, you know, by holding, you know, by covering up these stop signals that it might exist elsewhere, you can get immune effects in other parts of your body, your gut, your skin, and that can cause you other problems. And so this is one reason why my lab is trying to come up with much more targeted approaches to this. But the current ones that exist are, you know, given by IV injection and go everywhere.
Yeah. Do people and you said you use patients right now for your work, or people who are in this kind of situation, how do they, I mean, typically if there's somebody listening who might want to be a part of that, is there, or is it just you need to keep it to your own patients?
For the clinical trial that we're running or for immunotherapy in general?
For the trial you're running.
Yeah, so that'll open this summer. It's, you know, we publicize it as widely as we can. It's on, you know, government websites that host clinical trial information. But it's, I think it's a really next generation, extremely valuable trial, and hopefully will lead to the next frontier for us.
How many people will you be including in that trial?
There'll be 20 people. So it'll be a single institution trial, and there'll be 20 folks that are ultimately recruited to the trial. Clinical trials can come in a couple of flavors. One is large national trials, right, where it's trying to change the standard of care, and we're making sort of small gains in terms of how we change treatments because we're doing such a large trial. And then there are smaller trials that are run by investigators like me, where we're trying to make larger gains. You know, we're really trying to do disruptive things to cancer to really push the science forward.
That's pretty cool. And you don't have a typical trial where you would have patients that were not were given a placebo or something like that versus those who get the actual.
That's right. So you can run what's called early phase trials where there really isn't a placebo piece to this, like where we have a new exciting regimen and we want to see how it works. And we often will take biopsies of tumors before and after treatment so we can really compare in a very detailed level what the treatment has done. That helps us really understand mechanistically what are we doing and how can we make this better. And then there are really large trials where you really want to know if one thing is better than another, and that's where patients might have a placebo in one arm and the drug in another.
Mm. I was thinking back to some of the early research on rabies, and there was a vaccine developed to treat rabies, and they never tried the placebo on that. They just used so that.
That's right.
So that was a process that they thought, no, we're not going to give somebody with rabies a placebo. What's the most challenging aspect of your work, your research? Getting the money, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's from a pragmatic standpoint. It's, it's navigating the grant system and moving that forward. From an emotional standpoint, I think it's the slowness of scientific progress. That's just, it's the reality, right? It's hard and it takes time and it takes commitment. And all the while I'm still treating my patients with the best standard of care available, but that is still inadequate. And so that's what's the hardest for me, is knowing I can make gains in the lab, but the pace of it is slower than I need it to be for the patients I see every day.
So it's a little frustrating and probably heartaching when you think about it.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, people can people still sign up or try to sign up to participate then in these trials?
Yeah, we have a number of open trials. And again, we have to have a balanced portfolio. We span the gamut from really large national trials that we include to more progressive institutional investigator-driven trials. We're happy to see any patient who wants to come in from Wisconsin or outside Wisconsin who would be interested in our clinical trial.
And you can find that out at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Trials.
That's right. Yep.
Well, you're doing wonderful work, Dr. Zenga, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and hopefully we can get you back as things progress along this research. Dr. Joseph Zenga, Chief of the Division of Head and Neck Surgical Oncology and Reconstruction at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Great to hear about his research. Great to have a great team to work with. Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Dedeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.